until 31. And just to let you know that the philosophy and the way we're going to go through this course is completely different from the one we did. I don't know why you're laughing. I thought you were going to be sad and very worried. So this is going to be faster. Because we have much more to say.
Hence the need for a field theory.
No, well, but you were laughing for the correct reason, which is that this time we are all supposed to understand what I'm saying. That's including me. So in order to make sure that we do, and we all do, we're going to start with classical field theory. And since we don't have any quantum in the title, in the subtitle of this, so maybe I'm going to lose my voice at some point, so I'll try not to talk too much. We only have as a relevant as a relevant physical constant that we want to set to 1 the speed of light. So we're going to set the speed of light to 1. We're going to work in those units. Only around half of the lecture, we're going to encounter h bar, and then guess what? We will also set it to 1. But things, one thing at a time. Okay. So classical field theory. So what kind of field theories have you considered already? What kind of field theories have you met? Well, you have encountered electromagnetism. And actually, general relativity. Both are examples of classical field theories that are very successful. Okay? But today we're going to concentrate on electromagnetism. Now we know the world is quantum, so at some point we should aim to quantize these theories. Okay? And thus the need for a quantum field theory. So we're going to concentrate on electromagnetism. So what are the fields? Well, we all learned in high school that there is an electric field and there is a magnetic field. And what is the concept of field? Well, a field is something that permeates the whole space-time. In this case, in the case of the electric field, this is a vector at every point in space-time, okay? So that's why we have these coordinates, x, belonging to R3. So this is space. And we will denote t as time. Now we know that the world is relativistic. And actually, it's these equations, the equations that these fields satisfy, that basically told us that there had to be relativity okay, but in this form it doesn't quite look like that. There is a much better way of thinking about these equations. Is there a question? So, once again, this time we're all supposed to understand every single line that I write. So if there is any question at some point, you should feel free to ask, okay? But there is a better way of writing this, much nicer way. And this nicer way is to introduce an anti-symmetric rank 2 tensor called F mu nu. And F, as a matrix, is nothing but is anti-symmetric. So it must have, so it has the electric field in the zeroth components. You can guess what you have here, just from the fact that it's anti-symmetric. Now, in terms of this rank 2 anti-symmetric tensor, now, every time somebody tells you that they have a tensor, a scalar, or a vector, what is the thing that you should ask? So now I should ask you, with respect to which, with respect to what is this? Under Lorentz transformations. Very good. So Maxwell's equations can be rewritten in a very elegant way by, first of all, introducing this symbol. Okay. Now we are all relativistic. So what we meant by this is the following. X0 is time, and the other x's, xi, would be the components in a space. So using this fancy notation, we can actually write down Maxwell's equations in a very nice way. We have that this is true, and people usually introduce another tensor obtained from this one, which is called F star. It has components mu nu as well, and is proportional to the contraction of the completely anti-symmetric tensor in four dimensions and the F mu nu that we had before. And in terms of this, the other equations are also very nice. So this is the whole content of Maxwell's equations. Very good. So now we have our field equations. Just to keep in mind what our notation is, we're going to work in a signature, mostly minus. Okay, so this is our metric, eta mu nu. Very good. But before we move on and do fancy things with our classical field theories, let's actually review a little bit of classical mechanics. So in classical mechanics, we have some set of coordinates, okay? And associated to them, we also have some set of velocities. Okay, so here, q dot means derivative with respect to time. Very good. And in classical mechanics, we then start with an action which is an integral in time of a quantity we call the Lagrangian. And the Lagrangian is a function of our coordinates and velocities. So this object is called the Lagrangian. OK, very good. Now, the principle of least action or tells us that we have to extremize this quantity in order to get equations of motion of this theory. Okay? Our action is something that is called a functional. It's called a functional because it takes functions and maps them into the real numbers. If we had a function, the function would take real numbers and send them to real numbers. But this is a slight generalization of a function. Now, if we have a generalization of a function, when we want to take derivatives, if we want to extremize this object, we'll have to take variations. And the variations we're going to take will be variations with respect to the functions. Let me call this QA at some QT prime. Now, just like regular variables, right? So if you take the derivative of a given variable with respect to another one, you will get zero, unless the two variables are the same, okay? So here I'm gonna be thinking about QA and T. So I'm gonna be thinking about A and T as labels. I'm thinking that I have an infinite number of variables, okay? One for each value of T and one for each value of A. And when I'm taking derivatives, I have to take that into account. So what do I mean by that? Well, what I mean by that is that if I take the derivative, or in this case, a variation, maybe we can actually do it here. Let's take the variation of QA, let me tell QT of T with respect to QA of T prime. So what do you think this is? Well, I'm going to give you the difficult part, and you're going to give me the simple one. The difficult part is that this is delta AB. So what's the difficult part? Excellent. There is a Dirac delta of T minus T prime. OK. Now, this is everything that we need to know. The reason is that if we now want to compute the variation of anything, say we want to compute the variation of Q dot of B at T, QA at T prime, then all I have to do is to rewrite this in terms of the field, in terms of the variable that I have before. And the way I'm going to do it is by saying that I have the variation of this of the limit when delta T goes to zero. Yes, I'm going to use a high school version of derivatives. So we're going to do QB at T plus delta T minus QB at T divided by delta T. OK? Now this is a regular object, and I can apply my formula very happily. So what do I get? Of course, I get delta AB, because when I apply this to this and this, I get that as an overall factor, no problem. And I get the limit when delta t goes to zero, and I get delta t in the denominator, and this with this will give me a delta, Dirac delta, of t plus delta t minus t prime, minus delta of t minus t prime. But what could be this distribution? What could be the definition of this distribution? I'm just taking the Dirac delta, shifting it by delta t, is the derivative. So I get delta L AB delta prime or delta dot of T minus T prime. Okay? So armed with that, we're going to compute this variation, and then we're going to use the chain rule. So when we use a chain rule, what do we get? We are taking this variation of this object, and using the chain rule, I get derivative of L with respect to QA T, now variation of QA T, or actually, this is an A, and this index can be anything. I'm supposed to take all indices, so maybe I should use a B with respect to QA T prime. Plus derivative with respect to the other variable, q dot a or b of t, variation q dot b of t, q a of t. Okay. I don't think we're going to need this. Okay, so what do we do with that? Well, besides the fact that it won't be able to reach it anymore, so it's very important. Those equations are very important. They will stay there for the rest of the lecture. Yeah, it's tricky. You will see I'll suffer a lot. But it's a pity that the actual Euler Lagrange equations didn't make it to the board.
There is a typo in that board.
There is a what? Oh, that's what this was for.
Oh, I see.
Now we know. Yeah, okay, fine. Let's worry about that once the time comes. So what is this? Well, we just use our formulas there, right? So the first term will give us a delta function that we can use to carry out the t integration. And then we get... Now it's evaluated at t prime because we have the delta function. Okay. Now the next term, we get a derivative of a delta function, but as a distribution, we know that we get minus the derivative of the function we have, or the other way to say it is that we integrate by parts. Okay? So we integrate by parts.
So you can do that if you have test functions, right? So
yes.
In this case, what guarantees that you can actually do the integration by parts and do not have a boundary term?
Well, it's simple that simply that when we have the boundary terms, we're going to have everything evaluated still on a delta function that vanishes unless we're at t prime. And the boundary terms could be at some other t's. Could be minus infinity or plus infinity or t1 and t2. But those t generically differ from the t prime that I'm considering. Or if you want to be really, really rigorous, you would say that we will be assuming that the variations at the endpoints are zero. Okay. But then integrating by parts, we get now dt and this has to be equal to zero. Of course, the form that we know doesn't have the prime, so we can just forget about the prime if you want. And these are the Euler Lagrange. You might wonder why I'm doing this in so much detail. And the reason is that we will need that detail in order to generalize everything to a classical field theory. Otherwise, we'll get confused. Now, the last thing I want to mention here is the Hamiltonian. Why do you think I want to discuss a Hamiltonian? What do you think is my long-term goal? Why do we need a Hamiltonian? Sorry? Yes, somebody said it here. To quantize, right? Because we're going to do, in this course, something that is called canonical quantization. And in order to do that, actually, that was the original way. We only know how to do it if we start with a Hamiltonian. Okay? Of course, if you're Feynman, then you reinvent everything, and then you start with a Lagrange. In fact, you really have to start, the derivation starts with a Hamiltonian, but you could just start with a Lagrange. But we're going to see how far we can get just with the Hamiltonian, and let's actually do it here. So in order to define the Hamiltonian, we have to define the canonical conjugate momentum. So what's the correct order? Canonical conjugate. Moment. It would be canonical conjugate moment, yes. So what do? Well, we're going to use this formula too. We say, well, for a given variable, we define P to be this object. So we define these new variables. And then we use a Legendre transform to go from the Lagrangian to a new function, which is a Hamiltonian. defined as the sum over PA QA dot minus our Lagrangian. A simple exercise shows that P, H is only a function of P and Q. Okay? Now, something else that we might use in the near future is that Lagrangians usually start with a term that contains a kinetic term, something of the form like this, with a sum over A. So this is just an example of what a Lagrangian can have. In fact, then you have minus some potential energy. Yes.
Why does this work? We always do problems in classical mechanics and we say use Lagrangian as T minus V and then get the other Lagrangian equations. But why do we use T minus V or why does it work?
Well, why do you use T minus V? Well, the reason is a minus V is that in the Hamiltonian, V now comes with a plus sign. So it's actually an energy and it's positive. It's contributing with a positive sign to the energy of the system. Okay? And so does the kinetic term, right? The kinetic term has to come with a plus sign because, of course, I didn't put it here, but there is usually half. So that when you do this calculation, you also get a positive contribution from the kinetic energy. We're going to see all that in the field theory setup. This one, oh, this room doesn't have a clock. Okay, so we have that. Now we're ready to go back to electromagnetism, right? That's how we started the whole thing. We want to write down something analog for electromagnetism. After all, we all know this very well, and we know from here how we go to quantum mechanics. We just introduce canonical commutation relations, and we go from there. Okay? So if we can succeed in writing this theory first as a Lagrangian theory, and then compute the Hamiltonian, we might be in business. Then we can quantize this theory. Sounds very easy. So let's just try. Okay. That one is a we'll have to find a way to solve this problem, but okay. So what do we do? We want to find, well, let me also introduce a little bit of terminology. In classical field theory, we call the action, we call it S. Okay? So we want to try and find something of this form. Okay? Well, one problem is that we would like this action to be Lorentz invariant. Okay? So whatever we put in here should be Lorentz invariant combinations of these objects. So what are the natural Lorentz invariant combinations we can make? Well, we know already that they come together in a nice package. Okay? So we can make Lorentz invariant combinations of the form, say, F mu nu. If we contract this, all the indices with the Minkowski metric, we can get a Lorentz invariant. Okay? And this object is basically the norm of E minus the norm of B. Okay? We could also use the other tensor that we have, which is star, and contract it with this, and also get something that is a Lorentz invariant, and it turns out to be proportional to E dot B. There is immediately a problem here, which is that we don't see anywhere where we have any time derivatives. Okay? So that might be an inconvenient. The other thing is that T appears all by itself. So we would like to have a way to pair up T with also space components so that we can make something that is Lorentz invariant. Okay. So let's try to address the first question. The first question is, well, we have E and B. These are functions of T and X. But if we think about T and X, T is as the T that we had before, and X looks like a variable. Sorry, like an index. So we can think about the X as just being an index, very in the same way as we thought about A as being an index. Okay, in the previous example. It's just that in this case, it's an infinite dimensional set of labels. And in the previous case, it was discrete and finite. Well, we sure hope so. Okay? And we're going to assume so. So consider this case, okay? So whatever the Lagrangian is, if we try to construct something that has a kinetic term, we get things where we sum over the index, okay? So the Lagrangian doesn't really depend on this index. So the index is sum over. It's a way of tracing over this index, okay? So motivated by that, we are motivated to think that this, whatever this Lagrangian is, before we had a sum, so before we had a sum over the index A of some quantity. Now this index A is continuous. So we are going to replace the sum by an integral, and we're going to address it with a natural measure in a space. Why is this convenient? Because if you combine this with the dt, you make an element of volume in four dimensions. And that element of volume, what do you think? Is it Lorentz invariant? It is. So that's going to be a nice improvement on this formula. Now, of course, whatever we write here, I mean, it's a new object. And that new object is usually denoted with a calligraphic L, and it's called a Lagrangian density. Well, it's obvious why, because you take your Lagrangian density, you multiply by a little volume of a space, and you get a contribution to the Lagrangian. Okay? So that's what this formula is doing for you. Right. Yes?
So it's because it's a scalar density, if you there's a minus curve of G.
Yes, but we are in Minkowski space. Right? So in Minkowski space, what is that square root of?
Well, it's in Cartesian coordinates, it's 1.
And we're in Cartesian coordinates. Yes. Thank you. Yes, but we're in Cartesian coordinates. OK. That was one problem. And we fixed the problem. Now, this together with this looks very nice and Lorentz invariant. The problem is that we don't have derivatives. We don't have time derivatives. How do we fix that problem? Well, you all know the solution to the problem. The solution to the problem comes from this equation. When you look at this equation and you use what it is, this equation implies that epsilon mu nu rho sigma of f, so we take derivative, let's see, let's be careful with the index, mu, right? F rho sigma, that's fine. Has to be 0, OK? Now this one doesn't move. Maybe we can. Forget about this for a sec. Okay, so how do we solve this equation? Well, here, today and in the next lectures too, I'm going to be mentioning some facts that are not very important for what we're going to say, okay? or what we're going to discuss, but it would be nice if you guys could explore them further. Okay? So whenever I do, try to write it down and explore it. If you want to discuss it, then let me know and we can discuss it in private. Okay? So here is one of those cryptic comments. Okay? And it's the fact that when you see an equation like this, this equation has so here is your first cryptogram, which is to find out why I wrote local. So here I mean that we can remove it. You say this has a solution, but if you want to think further, think about the meaning of local. Why I wrote it there? And the solution is that f rho sigma is nothing but the derivative with respect to rho of a vector field. Okay, so here I have introduced a new vector field. Which is the vector potential. A mu, which again depends on t and x. Okay? So it's obvious that if we plug this and you put it in here, you get zero. Is it obvious? It's obvious, yes, because if you see you have this derivative with respect to rho and derivative with respect to mu, so you have mu and rho. This is anti-symmetric, and this is symmetric, so you get zero. And the same thing happens here with sigma and mu, sigma mu, and you get zero. So this is clearly a solution of this. Okay? Very good. Now, locally, this is the most general solution. Very good. Now, if we have that object, we can improve our Lagrangian or our guesses for the Lagrangian of electromagnetism. So a new try would be to have an action that is a functional of this A and is given as an integral over dt d3x, okay, of a Lagrangian density that depends on our field A. Of course, one of the components could be zero. So if it's zero, it's a derivative with respect to time. So that's pretty good. So we have time. But necessarily, if we're going to build things out of that object, or if you're going to build things that are Lorentz invariant, we will also have to allow derivative with respect to space components of a mu. Okay.
Why aren't we including a mu of t?
Yes, so my notation is that if you see that there is no arrow, if there is no vector, then I mean the four components, okay. Right? So let's settle on that on that convention. So I think consistent the whole time. So if you see an arrow, it's always a vector in three dimensions, and if you don't see it, then it means that I'm putting all these guys together as a single object. Of course, it would be nicer to keep an index mu, but then it will get confused with this index. So I'll just denote it as x. Okay, very good. So now we can try and guess what this object has to be. So let's try. We want something that is Lorentz invariant. In fact, now that we have the four things together, why not calling it d4x? And here I want to follow some convention. For our ansatz. Because tomorrow in the tutorial, you will do something with this. So this is one possibility. I'm just going to write down every possible quadratic object in the field that I can make that is Lorentz invariant, okay? So if you don't know what the answer is, you just try the most general thing and then see if you can make it work with some choices of the indices. This is another possibility. This C, of course, is not the speed of light, because otherwise it would be 1. So we have this.
You're taking just to up to order 2
in A,
right? But I can take any order of the power that I want, right? If I take each of these quantities and multiply them by themselves, there will be Lorentz invariant as well.
Very good, that's true. But now, what is our aim? We want to write an action that reproduces Maxwell. Okay. Now, Maxwell is linear in A. So we better not mess up with higher orders, because then we will not get it.
Probably the point that I'm going is that your Lagrangian density is not uniquely defined, right? I mean,
Just give me 5 minutes and the answer will be, you're right.
And
it's not uniquely defined.
Can I just add this?
Yes.
The first two terms, A and B, the prefactors, the actual terms are the same. So why are we writing them? Oh, they're not, oh, my bad.
Yeah, maybe you should check it, because maybe I tend to make mistakes when I copy from the Okay. But then, now we know what we want, right? So we want to reproduce Maxwell from here, but I haven't told you how, right? So we're going to follow, by analogy, the strategy that we did here, and we're going to try and design a strategy when we have fields instead of simple variables.
Can you just explain again how we get the structure for the Lagrangian density?
I just guessed it. It was just a guess. So we said it cannot be a function of E and B only. Those cannot be my variables, because I'm missing time derivatives. We know that one of Maxwell's equations is actually an identity that tells me that the field strength, F mu nu, that's how it's called, can be written as that total derivative. Well, maybe I should also have said it. If you want to be a little bit fancier, you can say, that's again another one of these quotation mark things. The equation that we had here is equation for this, thought of as a two form, to be close and locally can be exact, so it means that it can be written like this. But never mind that. We know that one half of Maxwell's equations are just telling us that we can introduce this new field and solve them automatically. Okay? Now we use A. And in these objects, there are natural derivatives of A, right? After all, there are derivatives of A. And we're just going to guess what the Lagrangian is. Clearly, we can not only introduce derivative with respect to time, because it won't be Lorentz invariant. So we have to introduce these ones in such a way that the whole combination is Lorentz invariant. This was Lorentz invariant, so we're only going to allow Lorentz invariant factors. And the question was, why only quadratic and not higher order terms, which we could also have written down. But the goal is to reproduce Maxwell, which is linear in A. And roughly, every time we take a variation of this, we lower one power of A. So we only need something that is quadratic in A. Okay? Very good. Now, let's try to develop. So I'm afraid we're still in the classical regime. So let's try to work out something more general that we can use all the time and not only for electromagnetism. So I'm going to replace this object, okay, by a more general notation that you will find in all books. So people usually talk about a field phi that has an index I and depends on t and x, or phi I of x. So the index mu here plays the role of our index I here, or vice versa. So now I'm going to work with a general object. It doesn't have to be a vector potential. It can be anything. Okay? Very good. What we learned from there is that we can now write an action which is a functional of this object and is given as the integral d4x of a Lagrangian density that depends on these fields and it depends on the derivatives. Okay? Now we want to find a way of extremizing this, just as we did in classical mechanics. But now we're going to do it for classical field theory. Very good. So now we can play again the same game. Exactly the same game. So I'm going to tell you what the easy part is. And now you tell me what the difficult part is. Which delta? Excellent. Delta 4. OK, so we're done. We just do the variation of this thing with respect to phi I of x prime and get, once again using the chain rule, of course, I put the primes in the wrong place, but you all guys noticed that already. Okay. Up to sines, factors of 2 and pi, this must be correct. Okay. So what do we get? Well, once again, this guy logs I and j, right, and produces a delta function. Which is great, because now with the delta function, we can carry out the x integral. The full x integral, we can do it with this delta function. And we get this evaluated at I, x prime. Once again, following exactly the same reasoning, which is somewhere. Oh. Yeah, that's why we put it up there, so that it will not get lost, okay? So we did it with the derivative with respect to time, but nothing important changes if we put derivative with respect to any of the x's. The same argument tells us that we can pull this out and get a derivative acting on the delta function, now integrate by parts, and get a minus sign, the derivative acting on and this must be zero. And as we did, we can, if we want, just remove the prime and just leave it like this. It looks more beautiful. And this is a very nice equation. Again, these are our Euler-Lagrange equations. So it's spectacular. We have an action principle for fields. So we cross our fingers and hope that by doing exactly this to our ansatz, you can land on something sensible. In fact, I'm afraid that somebody already did it, so you won't be able to write a paper with that. So, so I'll tell you the answer. So your job tomorrow will be to prove it. Okay? It would be a good exercise to actually do it. Okay? So the answer is that in order to reproduce so the choice of variables, in order to get an equation that looks like this, is the following. Of course, the overall constant doesn't matter, right? The overall constant is completely irrelevant. So I'll have to make a choice. And I'm going to make a choice that has physical significance later on. I mean, it's going to be convenient for the physical interpretation of the object. Plus C times okay. Now part of your exercise tomorrow will be to show, well, first of all, I got the equations for any value of C. So somehow this object must be irrelevant. Okay? That's precisely your question. Is this completely, is uniquely defined? And the answer is no. I can add things, and still the equations will not be modified. Now, part of your exercise will be, and don't ask if it's the same as the exercise, because we are supposed to do it, is to rewrite this in terms of f and star f.
Sorry, that's not my question. I mean, for the equations of motion, given the constant and whatever I add to it, won't affect the equations of motion, right? But if, for example, if I want to calculate quantity through the action, for example, the current or energy momentum tensor or stuff like this, that will depend on the constants that I have and the things that I add to my action. Right?
Well, in fact, no physical quantity will depend on this object, except for very, very sophisticated non-perturbative effects in quantum field theory. So this object will not be relevant, at least for us in this course. So we will see. Okay. So you haven't done it yet, but trust me, somebody did it. And this works. Okay? We're going to forget about this, and we're only going to concentrate on this. So this is exciting. We have a Lagrangian that describes electromagnetism. So we're this close to finishing the course. And in just 1 hour. So this is going to be spectacular. So we're almost there, right? Okay, the time has come to find out what to do. Yeah, it's this thing. Let me try. Oh, it wasn't that bad. Now we know. Okay. So any questions so far? Remember that we changed the mode and now this time the lecture is completely boring, and you're supposed to understand everything. Okay.
So where does the D term go from there? So the top nine is equivalent, is the same as the second nine, right? So can you sort of
so you just discovered that when you do the exercise tomorrow, you will find that D is equal to zero. Don't spoil them. Just do it tomorrow, okay? And find out that D has to be equal to zero. Okay, so what's the next step? We're almost there to quanti- I mean, we're almost ready to quantize the theory and be done with the course. So we have the action. What do we need now? We talked about that at the beginning, right? Yes, so we need the Hamiltonian and define the conjugate variables.
So you said that action will reproduce that equation. Right?
Yes.
So we also want to reproduce the other one, Maxwell's equations.
So yeah, very good question. Yes, so we want that to be reproduced. But remember, the other equation was the condition for F to be written in terms of A. So whenever there is an F that is written as a function of A, then the equations are automatically satisfied. So that's why people call them identities. So the next set of equations are not called field equations because they are an identity now. Okay? So these are the equations, and this is an identity. You see the difference. An equation is something that constrains your object. An identity is something that is satisfied no matter what A is. Choose whatever you want for A, this equation is satisfied. So it's not imposing constraints on A that the other one is. Okay, so we have to go and define our Hamiltonian then. We already have a Lagrangian density, so why not define a Hamiltonian density? Okay, so we're going to keep going along these lines in general, and then apply it to our example every time that we feel that we have finished something. So we have the equation for the canonical conjugate momentum. Okay, and so we're going to define the same thing here. Remember that our index A is now our space index. So people like to call the conjugate variable pi, and it depends on t and x. Okay? So what is this guy supposed to be? It's supposed to be the conjugate variable to our field phi. But now we're dealing with fields, so we're not supposed to take derivatives of the Lagrangian. We're supposed to take variations of the Lagrangian because we're doing our calculations with fields. So we take our Lagrangian, not the Lagrangian density, just the Lagrangian, and we vary with respect to the field. Well, this field can have another index, which is the index I, so we can put the index I here. And this would be our definition of the momentum. You see that it's identical. It's the same definition that we had up there. The only difference is that we replace derivatives by variations because we're dealing with more complicated objects, but it's exactly the same. Now, what is a Lagrangian? Well, if you look here, to find out what the Lagrangian is, it's not very difficult. We just, even though it hurts to do it, we're going to separate time and space, okay? We're going to give up manifest Lorentz invariants. But that's life. If we want to do canonical quantization, we will have to. Okay? So we have this integral dl. And whatever multiplies as dt has the right to be called the Lagrangian of the theory. So this is the Lagrangian of the theory. Of course, when you get into the field more in more advanced subjects, people usually call the curly A the Lagrangian. Okay? So don't get confused when most likely when somebody tells you, look, I have the Lagrangian of the universe. They are not talking about this L. They are talking about this one. Of course, the chances that they are making sense are very, very small. But at the very least, they most likely they are talking about this one, okay? The Lagrangian density. So we should take this variation on the Lagrangian. So let's do it and see what we get. V3x of
I'm not entirely sure why in this we don't just, we just use the Lagrangian, not the Lagrangian density for the conjugate momentum.
Well, because that's what we that's what we know from quantum, from classical mechanics, right?
But in classical mechanics, really have the concept of a Lagrangian density in that case.
No, in classical mechanics, we know there is time, there is a time evolution, and the other labels are labels, right? Are just labels. Here, space, from the point of view of classical mechanics, space are just labels, right? And this, the way I introduced this integral was by saying that we had a sum over all the labels, right? It's just that we had a continuous set of labels. Yes, thank you. So once again, maybe we can put it inside. Yeah, this time. So that I don't have to erase it in the end. Okay. So when we do this, what do we get? We do the variation. Again, we use the chain rule. Yes? Yes, so we have everything. Yes, sorry. It's just that the dot one was the one we wanted to keep track of, right? So actually, this variation is now a variation that will only change this field that has the derivative, OK? So we are only going to get derivative with respect to 5 dot. Yes, thank you. With respect to 5 dot. Okay, so now in these variations, we're only varying with respect to the space components. Okay, in all this equation, time is assumed to be constant. Remember, we gave up Lorentz invariance, manifest Lorentz invariance. So we're doing all this at a fixed time. So this derivative, this variation is now just a delta function in the space and a delta that fixes the indices I and j. So our canonical conjugate momentum conjugate to phi is then, not very surprisingly, this object. Okay, and what is the Hamiltonian? Well, we just look at what the Hamiltonian was there. We had the sum over all the indices A, the little a indices. Here, the little a indices are the x's, so we are supposed to integrate. And we integrate what? We integrate this minus the Lagrangian density. So what do you think we should call this quantity inside? Curly H, exactly. Yeah. What else? And it's called the Hamiltonian density. That's right.
How do the i's go? The i's are being summed over?
Yeah, the i's are being summed over, yes. Just like there, the a's were summed over.
Yeah.
Now, the a's are a collection of continuous variables, which are the x's, and discrete variables that are the i's. So I'm still summing over the i's and integrating over the x's. Okay? Now we're almost ready, unless something terrible happens that prevents us from reaching our goal. Okay? I mean, that could happen. And this would be a nice blackboard for that. You will see why. Actually has a meaning. So let's, again, back to electromagnetism and apply everything we have developed. So you say, great. So let's compute our conjugate momentum. What are our field variables? Yeah, it's silly to put ellipses only for the. But that notation is useful when you work in many dimensions. And you will see. So we have this. This is great. So let's just do it. I mean, we're done. Let's compute the conjugate variable to this guy. So what do we do? We take this guy and take the Lagrangian and then the derivative with respect to a0 dot of x. And then you very happily go and check in the Lagrangian, and then the Lagrangian is minus a quarter of then a nu minus a mu, and now you see that a disaster happened. What's a disaster? Yeah, we get zero. There is nothing here. You see the indices? This is anti-symmetric. So if any time you have an a0, this index cannot possibly be zero. So there is no a0 dot variable. Because a0 dot is derivative with respect to a0 of a0. There is nothing. Well, it shouldn't.
Perimeter has a lot of unique features, natural lighting to reduce our lighting requirements and make the space feel open and free throughout. And some of the gold glass on the north side is very unique as well. The chalkboards are abundant and they're everywhere you go, in the meeting rooms, in the classrooms.
No, it just means it
we have
means
a lot of intersecting areas within the building to promote that collaboration within the building. One of our mandates was to position the bistro at the
main. Very straightforwardly, because we're losing one variable. Remember that in this function, this is now not a function of this guy, and it's supposed to be replaced by the canonical conjugate moment. Okay? So our dream of finishing the course right now has been truncated by the fact that we cannot just straightforwardly write down a Lagrangian, a Hamiltonian, and then quantize. Okay? So in a situation like this, well, first of all, one of these exercises, try to think about why and why it happened. Okay? The question is intentionally very ambiguous, okay? Because it's a little shocking at first, and you will have to sit down and reflect on many things to find out what's going on. Okay? But try, nevertheless. As you tried already. That was very good. Now, but we have 3 weeks, so we have to find out something to do in the 3 weeks. Yes.
So saying that pi 0 is 0, saying that you cannot quantize the electromagnetic field in this way.
That's right. It means that electromagnetism it has a peculiarity. There is something interesting going on. Of course, I mean, it means that you cannot just do it following the standard rules, that you have to think harder about what the physics is. Yes?
So it seems like if you had left the FB somehow as arbitrary and put in that condition, maybe as like a Lagrange multiplier or something, would that cure it at all, or is that not?
Well, as I said, that's you're supposed to think about it, and we can discuss it in private. Okay. Now let's actually see if we can do something else. If there is any other theory that we can think of, that would be nicer. Of course, the other one that you know is GR, but I don't think that one is going to be simpler than this. Yes?
So what happens if you use a full Lagrangian, the one with the C inside?
Well, as I told you, the physical consequences of the other term are completely irrelevant. So you should also check that. Okay. But once again, we're not discussing this issue. This is a quotation mark question. Okay? So let's keep going. So we're searching for something else. So let's start by actually, by in order to search for something else, okay, we're going to search for a simpler theory, but in order to do it, we're going to make things more complicated first. Well, what we're going to do is a theoretical experiment, okay? We're going to take our Lagrangian for electromagnetism and say, well, our action was completely fine. We got equations of motion. Something good must be out of it. So it looks pretty good. Now, I mean, people would say that we experience four dimensions, and it's true, we experience four dimensions. But if you are a theorist, just like mathematicians, you can do whatever you want if you want to explore and have fun, right? So one thing that we can do is to consider electromagnetism in more dimensions. Why not, right? Since we cannot construct the Hamiltonian, let's do something else and see if we go somewhere else. So let's actually think about electromagnetism in how many dimensions you want?
N.
D dimensions. Yeah, that's N dimensions. Now, let's actually not be that ambitious. Let's actually consider it in 5 dimensions. Okay, just in 5 dimensions. Exactly the same object. So now I want to introduce some notation. I'm going to call indices M, indices that go from 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. And if I see only 4 indices, I'm still going to call them by Greek indices. Okay? That's a standard convention. People like to just, if you're working with more dimensions, you have an M, capital letters. And just the 4-dimensional indices are mu. So we have a theory that looks like this. Okay? Now, of course, I like math and so on, but I'm not that crazy to say that, well, I'm just going to consider this. And I say, well, if whatever happens, if I want to consider something that has any chance of having any physical significance, or at least to teach me something about 4-dimensional physics, I should think about this variable as something that is different from the rest. Okay? In what sense? Well, imagine that you have only the variables t and w. Okay, time and the variable w. And this is part of your spacetime. Now, what happens if I impose that all the fields that I have in my theory happen to be periodic in w, meaning that if I evaluate my field here, and I move my field a distance, 2 pi times some number r, I get exactly the same field. So I can impose that condition. You are all looking completely shocked and surprised by this. But this is what you would do in order to describe a theory that lives on a circle. Okay? If you now think that this new dimension is a circle, it's a little circle, then the way you would describe it is simply by saying that you have fields whose dependence on this new variable is periodic with a period 2 pi r. Okay? So this is equivalent, imposing that this is the same, the field evaluated here is the same as the field evaluated here, and it's the same as the field evaluated here, and so on, is the same as considering the theory living on a cylinder. Okay? I only took t and w because it's very hard to draw t, w, and the other three dimensions. Okay? In fact, it's not possible. Why are we doing this? Well, the reason is very simple. The reason is that we started with a vector in five dimensions. Okay? So we had our indices x, mu, and w. If we do this and we let just.
Is that m?
This is an m, yes. This is an m. We started in a theory that looks like E and m, but in five dimensions. But now we're doing something special to this coordinate, which means that really it makes sense to split this like this. Okay? Now, what is the relevant Lorentz group here? At the beginning, I had a five-dimensional theory, and I had this five-dimensional Lorentz group, right? But now I'm breaking that Lorentz group and saying, no. The theory is not living in five-dimensional Minkowski space. It's living in a four-dimensional Minkowski space, and the fifth direction is a little circle. So there is no Lorentz invariance in the whole object anymore. So I only have to impose Lorentz invariant in the four-dimensional space. So under Lorentz transformations in the four-dimensional space, in these variables, what happens to this guy? How does it transform? What do you think? It doesn't, exactly, it's a scalar. So now it's very important to talk about under what, right? When we say this is a scalar, it's a scalar under the Lorentz group of these variables. Okay? So it's a scalar, and people like to call scalars by the letter phi. Okay? Very good. So now we want to find out an action for that scalar coming from this Lagrangian. How do we do that? Well, time again. And what time? Speaking of time.
Under SO1,
exactly.
0 or just
SO3? SO3,1, yes. The other one is SO4,1.
Okay, before you proceed, so you want to fix this problem, right?
No, I declare that for this lecture, I'm not going to be able to get away and say and finish the whole course today. So I figure I'm not going to solve it. I'm going to try to do something else with my time.
Discuss the same problem.
Yes, but as an inspiration to get something that is okay. That is something that we can work with. Okay. So once again, this is not very uncommon, right? You're trying to solve a problem, you get stuck, and then you start to fool around.
Yeah.
But then you see that if you have any function that is periodic in one variable, what is the useful thing to do? We know that this function is periodic in this variable. So every time you see something like that, something should come to your mind immediately, right? A Fourier series, okay? So we are going to write phi in a Fourier expansion. So we write it as phi of x, and I'm going to call the nth mode as n. So this is I n w over r. That's the most general structure of my field phi, okay? And it's pretty nice because it's given in terms of objects that only live in four dimensions, okay? These modes here. Of course, phi, my original phi is real. It's a real value field, okay? It only takes values in the real, in the reals. And whenever you have a function that is a real function and you expand it in terms of Fourier modes, what does that mean? That implies it's a constraint for these guys. Do you remember what the constraint is? So there is a relation, and these guys, right? That's the condition for the field to be real. Okay, very good. So let's take our guy here and plug it into the Lagrangian and see what we get. So we get our Lagrangian is now an integral d4x integral dw from 0 to 2 pi r. That's all we do. Our space is now compact. Okay? And what else? Well, we have, let's only keep track of the terms that involve phi. Okay? So we have something that looks like minus a quarter of derivative with respect to mu of what this a4, I'm going to keep the a4, the number 4 here, because it's going to be important in a second before we go to phi. The guy here next to it in the expression for f will contain another field which is not a. So I'm not going to, no, it's not a4, so I'm not going to think about this. There is another piece here. And then I'm going to have these 4 here and other pieces here. Okay? Now I'm going to forget about all these fields. I'm going to concentrate only on my new, brand new object, okay? Which is A, 4. Now, I declare that A4 with the index down was phi, right? But this guy has the index up, okay? Not only that, when I do this expansion, it will appear twice, okay? So what do I get in the end? First of all, this is my field phi that I have here. But this guy is not phi, it's what? G mu nu, I mean, yes, the eta mu nu with 4 and 4, and that would give me what? A minus sign. Because it's another dimension of a space.
Oh, I'm not sure.
Yeah, yeah, we're using the mostly minus. Yes. Okay. Now, our friend appears twice in this expansion. With a minus sign, we get a half. So we get dw, a half of d mu phi. D mu phi. Okay. This by itself is looking pretty interesting. Okay.
Was that 2 pi r, or is that supposed to be 2 pi? The first time for the action.
Oh, yes. All right. So let's use our Fourier decomposition into that formula. So what do we get? We get an action of the form integral d4x. And then we're going to have, when we plug in the decomposition, something interesting will happen, right? The zero mode, the n equals to zero is called the zero mode, okay? For reasons I'm not going to discuss, but it's, well, yeah, well, it's obvious. It's a mode with frequency, with n equals to zero. So that guy appears once, and we can put it here. Okay. The other guys will be things of the form can you see why we're going to get n and minus n? Well, the reason is that when I plug the Fourier decomposition and I perform the W integral, only the value n and the minus n will give me a non-zero answer. Can you all see that? I'm going to plug into phi the Fourier mode, but I still have to do the W integral. So the W integral will give me something of the form W e to the I. So I'm going to have some mode n and some mode n prime coming from one phi and then the other phi, W over R. But this is proportional to the Kronecker delta that sets n prime to be minus n. So I only get this contribution. But remember what minus n was. From there, well, from the very top that is now hidden, from the fact that the field was real, this is nothing but the complex conjugate. And I still have the sum over n.
So you said that the phi n, those terms would be real.
Phi, as a function of x and w, is a real field. But the fields with that are not the zero mode don't have to be real. They are, in fact, complex, right? Now, very good. So we have found this action. In fact, this is exactly what we wanted to get. So this by itself is a very interesting theory. It's called the theory of a scalar field, okay? In this case, this is a theory of a real scalar. Phi zero is a real scalar, okay? So we're going, and both theories are called Klein-Gordon theories. Okay? And the first one, let's actually write them one by one. I mean, some people might prefer to call this something different because we can say that this phi is a real scalar, it's a real field. And this one is complex, so it depends on phi and phi star. Okay? Now, once you look at these theories by themselves, we go back to the question that somebody asked. What happened? Oh, that you asked, in fact. What happened to the last term in the ansatz that we had, right? Remember the term a mu, a mu? Yeah. If we had kept that term, we would find that there would be a term here of the form minus a parameter that people like to call m squared because it's going to be positive. And here, sorry. Okay. So this theory is a theory that we're going to study. And you can see why, right? Why do we want to consider this theory? Well, it looks like a very simple theory. And second, we're going to be able to define our Hamiltonian. So we're going to be in great shape. So I guess that's what we're going to spend the time doing tomorrow. Okay? But
why do we ignore the complex scalars?
Oh. Yeah, that would be such a terrible idea. Maybe that should be your homework for this week. Okay, we all know who to thank for the for the idea of the homework.
Yes. So you neglected all the terms that have to do with the electromagnetic potential, right? So from this, you're also getting how to couple matter to scalar field. I mean,
So basically, what I wanted to do was to motivate the appearance of these objects from something that we knew, right? And the only way to do it was really to go to higher dimensions or to go to lower dimensions. So we could have started with 4 dimensions and go down to 3, but then we have had to study this in 3 dimensions. So it was better to go up to 5 and then get it in 4 dimensions. Now you could ask, what's the physical relevance of these objects? We know electromagnetism is very important. It turns out that these, the complex scalars, are very, very important. That's precisely the field that describes the Higgs. Okay? You would say, well, maybe I don't want to study this because these are real scalars, so who cares? Well, but that's not a problem because we all know that if you have this is a real scalar, this is a complex scalar, but this object is real, right? Because we always have the complex conjugate. What if I write phi, this complex object, as the sum of 2 real components? So what happens when I do it here? Well, imagine that phi, my complex scalar, was some real phi, field phi, plus I, some another real field. Let me call this one phi A and this phi B. Okay? So if I did that and I plug it here, I get a theory with 2 scalars. So why study a theory with 2 scalars when you can do it in your homework? And we can do in the lecture the theory with 1 scalar. I mean, it's complete, the logic is flawless. So. Now, to your defense, that was already the plan. Yes.
So it seems to be a little bit abstract to go to a higher dimension, compactify it, and get a scalar field. Is there any other way to motivate it instead of visual?
Well, another way would be to say, well, now that you have a vector field, why not study the Lorentz representation, the representations of the Lorentz group, and try to build field theories for all possible representations? In fact, we're going to do that next week. We're going to do it for the spinor representation, which I won't be able to motivate exactly in the same way. So very good. So another idea for next week. So we're going to follow this other path. Okay. So I was told that I have to behave and I have to stop at 5. So that's what I'm doing.